Now, coming up this week in the House is the last week. Anna King will be moving the first reading of Therapeutic Products and Medicines Bill. This is the legislation which would enable New Zealand to ratify the treaty entered into Australia for a joint regulator. There is support for the first reading and referral to the Committee for Hearing Evidence. And then, through the remainder of the week, prior to the adjournment motion, it is planned to take the taxation, annual rates, etc. bill through all the remaining stages, take the telecommunications legislation through all the remaining stages. That's been a major project this year from the time at the beginning of February when I signalled in my Prime Minister's statement that we were looking at far-reaching reform to the regulatory settings in telecommunications. So from go to low, it's been around an 11-month exercise. Remaining stages also of the Weathertight Homes Resolution Services Amendment, third reading of the Law Reform Epidemic Preparedness Bill. That's a bill that's also had an enormous amount of work into it. And then to some first readings, finishing the Interrupted Run on Copyright Amendment, and first readings of the Social Security Amendments and the Health Commission Amendments as well. Apart from that, things I've already signalled will be released from today's decisions, and Michael Cullen expects to issue the tertiary education strategy Thursday. And come Thursday also, it's likely that David Parker and Jeanette Simons will be releasing the New Zealand Energy Efficiency and Conservation Strategy draft for consultation. In many ways a companion document to the energy strategy which was released today. And in the course of the week I will go to Hong Kong to carry out the program which was developed there. As you will have seen, the East Asia Summit has been deferred due to the fears of what a typhoon hitting the place where the East Asia Summit and all the ASEAN meetings might be. I understand that because the International Convention Centre had not been finished, a lot of the proceedings were to take place in the marquee on the beach in the face of a typhoon. It's not a desirable place to be. So that has been the prime reason for deferral, which could be to the middle of January or to sometime between then and mid-February, but there's consultations with governments going on around that present time. Any questions?
Prime Minister, the draft energy strategy, the document about climate change and how to address that, I just want to get from you what your definition of carbon neutral is.
Well, I've given that definition and asked Parliament on a number of occasions, which you could easily refer to. But what I refer to is offsetting carbon emissions by other means. Obviously, afforestation is one such mean. But the energy strategy, of course, is a very, very major document, putting the government's stamp on the direction for renewables, pointing in the direction of coal-fired generation over time, going out of baseload and into reserve generation. All that would change, of course, if the technologies to store carbon, sequester and store carbon become feasible. That would change a lot of coal. And given that we're sitting on 1,000 years of coal reserves, it would be a very interesting development for us. There's also in the strategy of a clear direction around more use of public transport, biofuels, energy efficiency in our homes, our businesses. It's a major statement of policy that's out for consultation. I think it deserves a serious study.
Where do you think, should methane be involved in that equation on carbon neutrality?
This is an issue that we sent David Parker and the government officials to Nairobi to seriously address. And we have discussed David Parker's report from the Nairobi meeting of the parties to the International Convention on Climate Change and the Kyoto Protocol. Our point is that to treat emissions, methane emissions from animals in the same way one treats, for example, carbon emissions from coal-fired generation is scarcely fair when it's rather obvious what you can do about emissions from carbon coal, for example. It's not so obvious what you do about methane emissions from animals. So there's, from what my reading of David Parker's report, is there's been quite an interest at the international conference about the points we're making. And there are a number of agricultural producers who are very interested in the science that we're developing. We will be world leaders in the science around pastoral emissions, pastoral agricultural emissions, and how to deal with it. While we would be the only developed country with an emissions profile with just on half the emissions coming from methane from animals, Ireland apparently has about 28% of its emissions coming from the same kind of source. So all I'll say is, so far so good, the issue has been well aired at Nairobi. There is, I think, a growing understanding of the issues for those of us with those kinds of emissions, and we are looking at how it could be dealt with in the post-2012 period.
So when you're talking about carbon neutrality, you're not considering methane emissions within that?
Oh, at the moment, we're looking at the overall issue of how we might aspiration reach carbon neutrality. But what I'm saying is that at the international conference, there was a good airing given to the issue around methane emissions.
So are you hoping that eventually there will be some kind of dispensation for methane emissions?
Well, it's a question of how it's treated in any post-2012 regime. And of course, right now there isn't a post-2012 regime. The issue is, will there be a post-2012 regime? So this conference in Nairobi is one we want to put on the table issues that need consideration in that period.
And to the Transnational Drug Authority, what leeway or flexibility will this mechanism actually have, given that, you know, you've obviously got some binding agreements with Australia?
The government regards the Trans-Tasman Therapeutic Agency as a very important development in terms of Trans-Tasman regulation. Very important development. And one of the many papers that we've had up, which I didn't mention today because simply review, but today we had the paper looking at the whole Trans-Tasman agenda. And as you know, through Michael Cullen and Leanne Dalziel's work, there's a tremendous amount of effort going into seeing how we can harmonise Trans-Tasman, how we get into those behind-the-border issues. So this document, this treaty, is a very early example of that. And I think it's very important that it's understood that unless complementary medicines are in, this treaty cannot stand. And that would be a very adverse development for the overall agenda of deepening economic cooperation and integration with Australia. And we've made the judgment that closer integration of the two economies is a good thing for New Zealand. But were the New Zealand Parliament to fail at this hurdle, then it will raise questions as to how we can proceed with discussion around Trans-Tasman economic integration.
Those two support parties, United Future and New Zealand Coast, are very wobbly on the issue of complementary medicines. I mean, you've got no guarantee that it will get, that they'll approve it. Have you beyond the select committee?
I wouldn't accept that description of their position, Ruth. I think that both of them have gone into it in a lot of detail. That when Annette King was working with the industry, the complementary medicines industry, on how to make the new regime encompassing them attractive, quite a big package was put up to support that. And there are now a lot of voices in that sector who are supportive of this. So what New Zealand First and United have agreed, having seen that package, having seen some of the quite significant support coming from it, for it, have said, well, look, let's get the bill to a select committee, and then the issues can be thrashed out. I don't know whether this is one of the issues that may have been discussed at the Trans-Tasman meeting on Friday, but it has been a source of some amusement that the National Party has consistently refused to give this very important Trans-Tasman treaty its support.
But they're not wobbly. I mean, are you confident that those two parties will support it?
I'm confident that they will give the hearing of evidence very serious consideration, and they will weigh up the New Zealand position.
The Australians have said no, we won't take up the complementary.
That's correct. That's why I say this treaty will fail if complementary medicines are not in, and that would be a very bad sign for the future and for the agenda that has largely had bipartisan agreement about working on behind the border issues and economic integration in Australia.
Tom PG, do you think it's a good thing that Mr. Ngarasei is planning to return to Suva? Perhaps a rallying point for opposition for the coup?
I think it's a brave move, because what we're hearing from Fiji is that people who are speaking up against the coup are being pulled into the barracks and bullied, intimidated. Someone told me that people are being forced to run around the parade ground. And, so, no, it's a brave move, and it may well be that that is the focus for some more opposition.
But is it your understanding that he went voluntarily to his home island, or that he was forced to stay remote?
I had a discussion with him at the weekend, and a lot of the information, of course, that's come out of Fiji, it's been hard to distinguish what's rumour and what isn't. But I now understand from him that he took the decision to move before dawn and was able to move undetected through roadblocks to get a helicopter out.
Would you be worried for his safety, though, if he returned? There have been some threats from the commander that anyone who speaks out will be, as you suggested, maybe even roughed up, or at the very least intimidated.
Yes, I'm worried for the safety of everyone who's speaking up against the regime, because it is ploughing on, seemingly oblivious to the avalanche of international criticism about what's happening.
The head of the finance ministry's latest reports has been now apprehended by the military and is in the barracks now, according to latest reports. Are you concerned?
Yes, I haven't heard those reports, but I am concerned for anybody who's pulled into the barracks and bullied and intimidated. And my understanding is that the finance ministry had quite a lot of controls on the public purse there, which it was very reluctant to relinquish to the military.
Damien O'Connor said earlier today that he had spoken with you at some point about the Liam Ashley report. I wonder if you gave him any instructions, sort out his department or anything like that.
We have had a discussion about it today. I have read quite a good deal of the report. I haven't read the whole thing, but I believe I've read enough to form a very clear impression. And the clear impression is that this was a gruesome murder which should not have happened. And there were clearly systems failures. This was an unacceptable and unavoidable death. Now, for the minister, he, after this murder happened, immediately required that over-18s and under-18s be separated, and that remains the case right now. The Cabinet fully supports Damien O'Connor in requiring that all the proposals made by the inspector who compiled the report are implemented, because no one wants to see this happen again.
Should he resign?
I think it's a case of the Bob Semple adage, responsible but not to blame. I have found Damien O'Connor to be a very compassionate and humane Minister of Corrections, and I believe he should fix this.
Should someone within the department resign? Should they be? accountable?
Well, that's a matter for discussion between the minister and the department. But suffice it to say, there were systems failures. The death was unacceptable. It was avoidable. It should not have happened. And the important thing is to get procedures in place so it cannot happen.
Did Mr. O'Connor offer to resign?
No, he didn't offer to resign because he was very fixed on wanting to fix it. That's his mission.
He's expressed confidence in Barry Matthews. Do you share that?
Yes, I do. I think Barry Matthews is an exceptional head of department. Again, the adage responsible but not to blame applies. There were systems failures, oversights, failure to provide information which could have, should have been provided, which you really can't explain.
You understand the frustration of the family, though, if in the end no one's held responsible, no one's held accountable for their son's death?
I entirely understand the family's feeling, because their son should not have died. The best way to honour the son's memory is to get it fixed.
Mr. Clark, have you had any assurances from David Benson folk that the allegations I investigated a couple of weeks ago were untrue?
I remember speaking with him the night papers, including their own, were making inquiries and being assured that they were without substance.
Do you know if he's taken any legal action against anyone?
I really couldn't comment.
If there is anything in those allegations, would that jeopardise his job in
Well, I just not even going to go down the track. I find the allegations bizarre.
Prime Minister, on Fiji, are you aware of any international activity designed to try to break what appears to be an impasse there?
I think that the Commonwealth will want to be in touch in the next little while. Commonwealth is always very solutions focused, and when something like this happens in the country, and it has played a constructive role in helping sort things out in Fiji in the past. I've been talking with some other South Pacific leaders in the course of the last few days, and people have contacts in Fiji, so I'm sure there's quite a lot of phone diplomacy going on, but the key thing is to see whether there's a way of resolving this and getting democracy restored quickly, or whether we're in for a long and rather unpleasant war in Fiji.
Are you disappointed that the UN isn't taking perhaps a tougher line?
I think the UN statements have been clear and unequivocal. If you're referring to the deployment of UN troops from Fiji, then of course they're dealing with the reality that Fiji has 300 troops in Iraq supporting the UN mission there, and there's not a lot of countries that put their hand up in there.